Welcome to Brand New Doctor. My name is Rolla Carajo, doctor turned healthcare graphic designer and brand strategist. This is the show where we share big ideas and look for inspiration in all kinds of places to help you grow a fulfilling career in healthcare. Following a path to success is one thing, but carving your own is another. So this is for you if you want to go beyond book smart. Today, I am joined by Leila Okai, founder and CEO of Diverse Minds. Leila is a thought leader in diversity, inclusion, and equity practices with over 18 years of experience working alongside senior leadership teams. Her work at Diverse Minds focuses on creating positively productive workplaces through training, coaching, and consultancy, with an emphasis on well-being, mental health, and race equity. Leila is also the host of the award-winning Diverse Minds podcast, where she delves into weekly discussions on mental health and inclusion. As a TEDx speaker, Leila's talk, The Connection Between Race, Culture, and Mental Health, has reached audiences globally. With her expertise as a trained coach, mentor, speaker, and mediator, Leila guides individuals to reach their full potential while prioritizing their well-being. Leila's impressive career includes serving as the head of the Center for Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion at Imperial College London, where she has led a team through various strategic initiatives. Leila has also pioneered important changes at the University of Oxford, starting with a focus on increasing applications from young people from ethnically underrepresented backgrounds. She later became the university's first specific advisor for race and religion. So thank you and welcome to the podcast, Leila. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's very exciting to be here, Rolika. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So it's going to be a great conversation because, you know, this podcast is about exploring our potential and having a positive impact through the process of doing just that, basically. And it's really difficult to actually explore your potential if you have the weight of institutional or cultural racism bearing down on you, or if you're struggling with your mental health. So I really want to dive into how we can improve well-being and help people from different backgrounds succeed in healthcare. Before we dive into the episode today, I just want to take a moment to tell you about the upcoming launch event of a project I'm really excited to share. It's a celebration with an exclusive workshop for a health branding and design collective called And Matter. This is something I've been working towards for a couple of years now, which brings together creativity and medical expertise in an exciting new way. The name, the work, the philosophy is all based around a vision of humanizing healthcare through design. So what does that mean? Well, so much to come in the future, but for now, what that means is crafting brands and digital experiences in the healthcare and health tech space that embody humanity, healing, and trust. I'm going to show you a lot more of my design work. And because this is a collective, I'll also be working with some people I really admire, including Dr. Giles Morrison, someone who has featured on the podcast before. So what better way to launch And Matter than to celebrate and dive into an exclusive workshop on humanizing health brands? We'll be exploring how we can connect with our audiences on a deeper level and how we can transform the experience of healthcare for everyone involved, whether that's patients, clinicians, or other professionals. It's free for you to come, and it will be hosted at Health Foundry, a health tech hub in central London. You can connect with me and with other like minds who are passionate about reshaping healthcare with empathy and creativity. So if you are building a brand in the healthcare space, I would love you to join us for our launch on Wednesday, the 24th of April at 6 p.m. at Health Foundry. Follow the link in the show notes to sign up. I just can't wait to see you there. But for now, on to the episode today. Can we start with your journey and your story? What has led you to where you are now? I've heard, you know, I'd love to hear about the good influences, but also the difficult things that you've had to overcome to get you to where you are now.
Yeah. So I think it's what you said really, Rolika, about the way in which we cannot achieve our full potential when the weight of institutional, subtle, yet very present racism is bearing down on us. I think that's such a sad but very helpful and succinct way to phrase it. So I never expected to have my own business, which is something I think you probably know I talk about a lot. And I always thought I would, my goal was to be quite senior, to become quite senior in higher education. But as time went on, I knew that wasn't going to be possible. And there were just too many barriers. And I think barriers that it wasn't really worth me fighting and jumping over. Because it you're facing an endless battle. And I think now, so I turned 40 in 2022, I just realized I spent so much of my life desperately trying to be seen. And that's not being seen in terms of, you know, getting out of a limousine and paparazzi, but that's being recognized for my work. I was desperate for recognition. I was desperate to be told you are enough. And I think a lot of that comes from, you know, upbringing, and it takes a long time to realize that. And I think we take often our unmet needs into the workplace unconsciously, because often we don't even know what our unmet needs are. And so I just wasn't going to get that. I wasn't going to get that because the jobs that I had chosen to do, which is, hey, this isn't working, look over here, you need to be better at this, are not what they want to hear. So it wasn't like I was doing admission numbers and going from, you know, 3,000 international students to 5,000 and I can show it and I can put a figure on that, which I don't think is correct, but it is what happens. It's the reality. And so, you know, that's not to say, you know, I absolutely loved my job at Imperial. I loved that job and I loved my team, many of whom are still there, and I miss them dearly. But I couldn't stay there forever, because we can't, I don't think, stay in one place forever. But interestingly, you know, the business found me because I was given such a license at Imperial. I mean, I had a really good budget and I would do things. And one of the things I did was to train as a mental health first aid instructor, and the institution paid. And I remember it was summer 2013, so over 10 years ago. And I ran two pilot courses, one with nine people, one with eight people. And I thought, okay, well, we'll see how it goes. And they were just full. And we had to have train about 12 people. And other universities were like, oh, how did you do that? Come and talk to us about it. So I'd go and I'd talk. And then, you know, I told my manager and she said, no, that's fine. But any money you get needs to go into the departmental budget. I was like, okay, that's cool. We can use it for away days. I can use it for staff training. And then it kept happening. So I bought an extra annual leave and it kept happening. And I thought, maybe there's something in this. And that's kind of what happened. And I think it's that freedom and autonomy. And I remember having a conversation with my dear friend, Janet Morgan, who works on race and neurodiversity, particularly dyslexia. And I remember saying to her, but I'm not going to have an @imperial.ac.uk email address. No one's going to want to work with me. She went, Layla, come on now. Like, all that's changed about you is an email address. And so but it was that process of trying to go through that. So yes, I think it's a mixture of realization, maybe some painful realizations, and also the networks and support I had that let me go forward. And I guess the perception of jumping off of a perceived cliff.
I can definitely empathize with so many things that you're saying. This idea of going into something with your unmet needs and looking for that process you're going through, or whatever kind of test you're putting yourself through, as a way to kind of meet those unmet needs. It makes me think about why I went into medicine in the first place, really, because I had this kind of desperate need to prove that I was smart enough, because my early experiences in school were really awful in the UK, basically. And this was in Ipswich, which is in Suffolk in the early 90s. So you can imagine quite how racist it was then. I was one of very few black children in the school. So it was for decades. So it was, I can also understand that idea of a really long period of time, it being something that is important to you to have met in some way or another. So it's fantastic that you've made this switch and you're able to make an impact to so many people still, but doing something that is really, really meaningful to you. So what I wanted to ask you about really was your view on mental health and race and how these things come together. I really appreciate the way that you talk about this. And this was the topic of your TEDx talk. Can you explain why it is important to make this connection between race and mental health?
Yes. And I think there's three bits to that as well. There's mental health, there's mental ill health, and there's recovery from any mental periods of mental ill health, diagnosed, undiagnosed, chronic, acute, etc. And I think that a lot of mental ill health is sadly caused by racism. That could be stop and search from police. That could be microaggressions, could be macroaggressions. It could be a one-off incident. It could be repeated incidents. It could be not being able to progress at work. And no one said it's because of your skin color or your culture, but you have a sensation about it. So I think we can't separate them as well, because so we've got what might trigger mental ill health. We've also got, it could be a long-term thing. It could be a short-term thing. And then the third thing is around the recovery. And I think Eurocentric recovery models may not work for us as global majority people, even if we identify as, you know, we live in the global north, or we identify as British people or American people or Australian people. You know, South Africa is a really interesting example. It's their country, it's their land as Black South Africans. And, you know, they are a majority, but yet the systems aren't necessary. The system, well, we know the story, but I don't want to comment too much because I've not lived there. But, you know, even then, in countries where Black communities may be the majority, their healing methodologies are not given front and center stage. They have to fight for that. And so I think things like talking therapies are useful, but actually sometimes it's not talking therapies. Sometimes it's having the space and the understanding, and also not having to sit there and explain things and to say, oh, you know, I think we talked about this, Roleke, didn't we, about, you know, some of the family things that, you know, just put boundaries around it. Well, it's really not that easy for us to do. We can't go, no, I'm not listening to you. I'm not. I'm going to live my life and walk off. That's not how many of our global majority cultures work. I also think a lot about the Southeast Asian communities in the wider sense in the UK, and just how I don't know very much. And also because I feel there isn't much information, or certain communities are pushed much more into silence. So I think some communities have resources stripped away from them. I think some communities are much more pushed into silence. And it looks slightly different for the different global majority diaspora communities we have. But we cannot. And I think the other thing about mental health is the legacy of trauma and movement and enforced movement, and not all of it was desired migration. Some of it was forced migration. Some of it was, here's a fake invite. And some of it was, we have to move because we don't feel we have a choice. You know, this is not people traveling and being treated like, you know, the whole thing around language, how why English people are called expats and we're not. Why are we not called expats? Why are we not called, you know, expats of Nigeria or, you know, South Asia, etc.? So I think we can't separate them, because our lived experience is our mental well-being, and our mental well-being shapes our lived experience.
I think that is such a closely tied thing. I've definitely had conversations with people when I'm talking to someone, perhaps like a coach or someone who's supposed to be mentoring me, who's not from the same background as me. I find their topics that they just don't come to me. It doesn't even occur to me to tell them about my racial kind of difficulties with things, or how race feeds into things. And when you speak to somebody else who does come from that background, it's almost natural to bring up these topics, because it is just part and parcel of everything. But it's funny that you just learn because of where we are, where we grow up and what we're used to. You kind of learn to compartmentalize. And it's only when you are kind of given that permission to talk about these things, or you feel that, you know, you feel that it's safe to, that you can connect all of the dots. You break down racism to three levels, which I find really, really interesting way to look at it, in terms of the people who are affected by it and how racism appears on each of these kinds of stages. So you talk about the individual, the institutional, and the structural. Can you explain this and how we can apply this to understand racism within the healthcare system?
Yes. And one of the examples I give is about the NHS. So what I would say is, you know, it is not my model. It's a model that has been around and has been shaped by predominantly African-American researchers. And I can send links for the show notes, because I really want to give credit where credit's due. But so it feeds up and feeds down. You know, people say, well, I'm not racist, I don't do anything. And it's, you know, it's really unlikely that we're going to see people in professional workplaces holding placards saying X group go home, or they're standing with race hate speech. We don't really see that in the UK. But we will see things like people not challenging, people not saying, wait a second, we haven't heard from our colleague over here. okay, so someone's come into this interview and we've got perceptions about accents. Let's explore that. That's an individual sort of buying into the silence. Then institutional, again, no professional workplace has poor policies and practices written down. So they're very well written. They're based on, you know, information that might come from employment law and also HR managers, etc. So the policies look really great on paper, but they are more than often applied inconsistently, like we see in the GMC's fitness for practice cases. So we know that Black and Asian doctors are far more likely to be hauled up for fitness to practice cases than their white counterparts. You know, the Harold Shipman thing, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but it is, if that had been a Black or Asian doctor, I don't think that would have happened. Same with the nurse in the Lucy, was it Lucy B case?
Yeah.
So that's another example. If it had been a nurse who had come from India, for example, no chance or very slim chance. So that's an example of inconsistent policies and procedures. We also know that nurses from global majority backgrounds are far more likely to experience harassment and bullying at the hands of white superiors, and that how that goes unaddressed, and there's very little repercussions for those seniors from white majority backgrounds. And then at the institutional level, how policy is set. So if we think about who's making the decisions at the Department of Health, which data is being looked at, how it's being looked at, the lens in which it's being looked at, who's in control and in charge of those ultimate decisions, we know that things aren't being really looked into from a really wide perspective. And that's, we're talking about race today, but we're thinking about socioeconomic background, we're thinking about access to spaces and places, religious diversity and perspectives, LGBTQ+ perspectives. Of course, this year's LGBTQ+ History Month is all about the scope, under the scope and the LGBT+ communities' interaction or not with healthcare, but also as healthcare providers. So all of that feeds up and it feeds down. So we see it quite a lot in the healthcare space, actually, and as patients too. You'll be very aware of the 5x more campaign, the fact that, Black women in this country are 5x more likely to have an extreme complication or pass from childbirth, not believed in terms of pain, assumptions being made about South Asian women and the fact they can't speak English when, some people might have a slight accent, but most South Asian women can speak many languages, actually. So all of that and what that looks like. And we see it all the time, people saying, oh, I don't want that doctor. There was a horrible article, actually, that I saw in the day. I was actually searching, for example, about schemas, and I typed in something in it, and there was a Daily Mail thing about top 10 surnames of doctors. Number one, Khan. And it's And I think it's interesting, about this perception of who is competent, who is allowed to be competent, who is incompetent. And I kind of make this strange joke because for me, and this is admitting my own biases, but I'm happy to do it, is if I go to a chemist and I don't see a Black or Asian chemist, I'm kind of looking around going, where's the chemist? Where's the pharmacist? Because I'm so used to Black and Asian chemists serving me, pharmacists, I should say. I'm just like, sorry, what? And so, but I'm not, I don't write articles in the Daily Mail and make a big song and dance about it. But it is interesting how we are all conditioned in particular ways, but we can be aware of that. And I think it's the hatred behind that that obviously is deeply, deeply damaging and worrying.
Yeah, this is a whole conversation in and of itself. We could talk for hours about this, about all of the different players involved and all the different people affected. I guess it's really interesting. A lot of what you say, I can empathize with as a patient and as a doctor. Actually, it's very it's very interesting to kind of slice it from these different angles. I want to talk about the strategies that we can be using at each of these levels, at the individual, the institutional and structural, that will help us to kind of improve well-being through the lens of inclusivity, diversity, and equity practices. What can we be doing in the healthcare system? Obviously, again, we're not gonna cover everything, but I wonder if you have some initial thoughts on each of these levels, what we should do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there was a lot of training that went on across all NHS trusts, pretty much, definitely in England, when the Black Lives Matter 2020 movement was happening. And there was a lot of talk about race equity training. NHS trusts have a race equality service delivery plan. It's not that it's not there, But it's how does it sort of come to life, A, but B, when people are challenged, to not feel like you're saying I'm a bad person. So some of that is really about sitting in the discomfort and going, sugar, I need to reflect and think about what I'm doing. I think there is also a trend for these quick answers, like, okay, you tell me what to do and I'll just do it. But I can't do that because you've got a person in front of you that isn't me. So you have to, or a group of people, or a meeting where there's a dynamic, and I can't be there and hold your hand. And even if I were there, that's one perspective of how to manage something. It's not the only answer. So I think people have to sit in discomfort. I think they have to be okay in ambiguity. I think they have to keep doing the work. You don't go for one run and then you're fit. You don't learn to read and write at age 5 and write a best-selling adult novel the next day. So these are all things that are work in progress. They're part of your development plan as a human. And you have to be okay with making mistakes because you're trying things out and being uncomfortable. So I don't think it's a lack of information and awareness. I think it's the application of that and the fear that stops people from doing things. Then I think at the institutional level, you know, there's a lot around how things are distributed in an organization, particularly NHS trusts around this work as well. So you've got the individual element, but also how the trust is set up. How much is going to the executive team? How are they leading? What's the role modeling from the top? I think most trusts do some great events, but then how is that really being embedded, and how are you capturing the data around the policies and procedures that you have? We don't want to burden staff networks with extra work, but how are you really using that input? And also, why are there policies and procedures that aren't really fit for purpose, particularly around disability, bereavement leave? These sorts of things really, really hurt people, and they are often not applied consistently. It's like, oh, we like you, so we'll twist the policy this way and it will be a bit more lenient. Oh no, you're a band 3 and we don't really like you, so we're going to twist the policy that way and make your life really difficult. And that needs to stop. And I think part of that is around also HR as well, and HR, the culture around HR can be very toxic. So working with organizational psychologists and things to work on that. But again, you need really good leadership from the top. And then finally, institutionally, you know, I think we need a change in government, but I don't know if the change in government that people are expecting is the answer either. But I think that it is around, you know, firstly, acknowledging, you know, this government just do not want to acknowledge that racism exists. So that's a huge problem. And also, you know, they don't want to give pay increases to healthcare staff. They don't want to acknowledge that, you know, consultants, yes, they might be paid a high level, but many consultants are working in some horrendous conditions. And that isn't okay, actually. So there's the work time directive stuff, but there's also the space that they work in is actually quite horrible. And and I know you can't change hospitals overnight, but it's that planning and thinking about people's working environment. I think we've got to think more than about cost. So it's not about throwing money away. I'm not saying it's an empty money pit, but the proportionality. So it's okay that we have Trident and that costs $3 billion a year, but it's not okay to think about the healthcare and actually things like social prescribing, things like systemic that stop people, that are more likely to stop people getting so unwell because of social factors that they then need £40,000 worth of surgery. Now, of course, if they need that, they need that. I'm not begrudging that in any way. And I think I'd much rather my tax money go to that. But if someone is deeply lonely and isolated and we can support them to connect and have friendships, then their physical health, we know there's lots of research globally done on this, is likely to improve and they're less likely to get super, super unwell.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. So technology is playing a big part in healthcare. And I spoke with someone that you know well, Dr. Annabelle Shoemimo, about the dangers of AI and learning racial biases and perpetuating them on a larger scale. But I would love to talk to you about your thoughts on technology and how you might want to see technology being used to improve diversity, inclusion, and equity in the workplace or in healthcare.
It's a great question. And when I read it, part of me thought, do I know enough about this to answer it super well? But I'm going to try. And I think that, you know, I'm going to go back to Imperial and say there were amazing inventions, creations, and things being done by students there at all levels, undergraduate, postgraduate, taught postgraduate research, PhD level. And a couple of things stick out in my mind, but one of them was an incubator. I think he was from India, and he'd made an incubator from a cardboard box, and it was fully functional and it worked. And so there is lots of innovation there. There is lots of, and that's the boundary, isn't it, between sort of invention and then technology as well, if you see what I mean, because obviously that would then have to feed into systems and monitoring, et cetera. And also the Althea Prize, which is an enterprise prize for women at Imperial. And it was a very special, it looked like a flower, a sanitary towel, created by a Southeast Asian student. I don't know whether she was Southeast Asian, British, or from Southeast Asia, but really interesting innovations. So these innovations are happening all the time, actually. So they're two examples. They're things I know from the newsletter. They're things I know from having worked there. These things are happening all the time. There are so many things, you know, how to monitor things, how to check for dementia, but how are they? My stumbling block is always, where are they in the mainstream use, but also in the mainstream usage? So I appreciate that things will have to go through clinical trials. I appreciate you can't just have an invention and it goes straight to use, but and it has to be very thoroughly done, because again, it's that thing between risk and innovation. But it seems to be getting very stuck these days. I think one of the other things is around, you know, cannabis research. We had an opportunity at one point in the UK to be a leader in cannabis research, and it didn't happen. And I think it's a real shame, because this isn't about drug use. This is about cannabis. You know, what a famous researcher, actually, someone you might want to talk to, Yuande Okelwu. She talks about, I went to one of her talks, and she talked about the fact that cannabis can mimic most of the hormonal functions in the human body. And this is not about drug use, but in order for us to know this, we need to spend a lot of money on research, because one of the issues with CBD, et cetera, is we don't really know the dosages for different things. So yes, CBD eases pain. Yes, CBD can help with menstrual challenges. Yes, CBD can help with menopause journey, but we don't know the dosages. We don't know when, we don't know how to take them. You know, they're going to be different for different people, as we know, because everyone's body chemistry is slightly different. So I think the opportunity for innovation is just everywhere. And I couldn't agree more with those points about AI and the challenges and the racial biases and who's doing it. And again, it goes back to that institutional and individual and structural racism. But I think the ideas are there. You know, even if we think about the crossover between climate chaos and injustice in healthcare, that's huge. But we have things like permeable concrete, but it's not being used. And that doesn't need a clinical trial. We know things like in hospital care settings, curves and color bring joy and help recovery, or having a beautiful scenery. And we can't always have that. I understand that. I'm not saying we knock down hospitals, but, you know, rooftop gardens or green spaces within there, using community groups to do that, getting donations from nursery to greenify spaces. This is all possible. I'm flummoxed as to how and why it's not happening. And it's certainly now, in the last 4 years, it just feels like we've really tipped down a slope.
Yeah, this is a deeper question. I guess it's hard for us to answer it right here, but understanding why it is we're slow to act upon knowledge that we already have. I can only guess that it's something to do with, you know, us as individuals. Often that's the case for us, just on a personal level. You might know something and it takes you a long time to get there. So imagine then on a bigger scale with an organization of millions of divergent minds, how difficult it is to finally arrive on what is necessary, the needed thing that, you know, what we have to do, basically. So yeah, I guess that's one for us to ponder on, really. But I would love to talk a little bit more about cultural weight, which was something that we started with. And when I came on your podcast, we talked about the cultural weight that can limit people from the global majority from making decisions around their career based on joy. And we tend to focus more on making decisions out of responsibility a lot of the time. And like I say, this can be very limiting, and it can make it very difficult if you are wanting to explore different alternatives in your career. And that was certainly the case for me for a while. So you provide training and coaching working with Black and minority ethnic people to help them achieve their goals in their career. Can you share some more of the common problem areas and the strategies that you use to help them on an individual level to get to where they want to be?
Yeah, thank you. That was one of the questions I looked at and thought, wow, this is such a big question. So I think it's always about looking at culture as a strength and their culture. So first of all, how do they define their culture? And as we know, two people can identify in very similar ways and yet put emphasis and weight on slightly different aspects of their culture and what's important to them and what's their cultural signature, and also where they want to be in terms of their career, but also their well-being. So what's important to them in looking after themselves. And sometimes people have never thought about that because we don't have the time, we don't have the opportunity. It's seen as indulgent, it's seen as not for us, which plays into the cultural weight. And then it's about exploring the different ways to do that. So going back to that point around really struggling to be heard and communication and how we communicate in high context cultures, which most of us are from, versus low context cultures, which is our, you know, our workplaces, is I'll often use a tool called TetraMap, which is not a psychometric, but it looks at the nature of communication. And it's not about changing who you are, but it's saying, okay, when I walk into that meeting, I know that 9 out of those 10 people, they're what's called high air element. They just want the data and they want to get things done. I'm all about connection and ideas, but what do I need to do to be heard? But I'm not changing myself. I'm saying, good morning, everyone. How are you? I'm going to show you some data to get started. Maybe that's not what I'd normally do, but I'm going to do that. So that's one thing we talk about. And also using the wellbeing and resilience at work tool, which is a psychometric around wellbeing and resilience and where people are. There's 5 different areas and how they then can create an action plan from that. And something I've just finished my part 2 in, and it's developed by the brilliant Andrea Watts, is using collage as a coaching tool. And it's the CCT trademark technique. And it's you. And what's great about this is it's not a vision board. It's actually using your, it's finding images. You think about a question before the session, then you don't really revisit it. But in the session, you make the collage. And then me as a coach will ask the open questions about what kind of, what do these images mean to you? And actually you get some very powerful things from the subconscious. It is creative. It's enjoyable. It's not about arts. It can be, but that's not the primary focus. And so it's touching on all these different areas that then enable people to start thinking and expressing. And how I got into that is, you know, there was that turning 40 was very difficult, not because of the age, actually, just because it felt like this kind of stuff going on. And I started making collages. So I started making little collages and I started doing things to try and work things out and just putting them around my office. And they're still here to answer my questions, because sometimes we really don't know. And I think we can go into that, right, goals, let's go. Goal number one, how's it gone? What are you doing? But actually, that's not the way I like to coach. I kind of like to say, okay, well, where are you now? Where do you want to be? Let's look at the different tools. What would you like to work with? I'm inviting you, nothing's mandatory. What feels important to you right now? And of course, it's not just a job. People are juggling, you know, their past experiences, their lived experiences, family, however did they define that in the moment, friendships, connections, and that's all part of them and their journey and the wider sense of goals, because you don't really arrive somewhere on your own, and you can't and you shouldn't, actually, because I think it's quite damaging. But yes, so those are some of the approaches I use.
Wow, I love the sound of the collaging one in particular. I have to say, there's a kind of a special place in my heart for that, because honestly, some of my favorite memories from growing up were me just by myself collaging. It's funny. I've never really thought of it in the sense of a therapeutic thing, actually, but it massively was, I think, for me at that age. And you're right. It does. The images that you choose are a kind of expression of, you know, what you're drawn to, and is a really good way to kind of explore your mental, really. So I think that's a great idea, and I'm excited to hear more about that. So I just want to finish off by asking you to imagine for a moment that you are the dean of a university and you can influence the curriculum in any way you see fit for students who will one day become future healthcare and health tech professionals. What would you want them to learn about well-being through the lens of diversity, inclusion, and equity? And how would you want them to learn it to help them to lead more fulfilling and impactful careers?
Again, a brilliant, brilliant question. And I would probably go wide in the aisles with this one. I think I'd be very renegade. I think I'd be on the cover of the Daily Mail every day. I think for me, it would really be, I think one of the first things is the piece of education about history. So the legacy of colonialism, and that's not to traumatize our global majority students, but actually then for maybe, you know, have those sessions and also have sessions around how you want to connect with your history if you are from those groups. I think that's a really key thing. So it's part of decolonization, but it's really going into that. And then having some epigenetics experts and trauma experts to also educate from the world, really from the world, and looking at models that have worked and looking at things like how have Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa supported mental well-being. There's some very interesting discussions about that. Some people feel they really weren't very useful. So again, I think it's talking about those things. I think creating safe spaces. And I think really this point around, let's move away from well-being being about drinking a smoothie on Instagram, because there's too much of that. I think another thing is to have students from different generations and different places in their lives together to learn from one another. So I'm really keen on peer learning. Peer coaching would be another thing I'd probably do. Coaching skills, questioning skills, listening. I think we've lost the art of listening as well. I think it's very challenging because there's so much noise in the world. And really, you know, which elements of your culture, and everyone has a culture. That's the other thing. Every single person has a culture. We see in this country, in the UK, is standard. It's a dominant culture, but it's not without culture. Because often if I ask people to define their culture in a white majority group, they'll say, I'm just normal British. And I said to someone, can you tell me what that is? What is normal British to you? And they couldn't answer that question. So it's the point around, what do we mean by culture? How do we define our personal culture? How does our culture link to our mental well-being? What is our mental well-being signature beyond, you know, this whole idea of drinking smoothies and doing yoga, which again, we've got a whole cultural appropriation story around yoga. You know, yoga was actually banned in occupied India for, you know, us as South Asian, you know, people of the soil. So, and now it's become this industry. So again, you see, I didn't know that till recently. And I read this very interesting paper about it. So we often don't know what's hidden in our own histories. So yeah, that's what I do. And to think about that, really, that global perspective around healing and reconciliation and trauma and epigenetics as well.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on so many of those points. I think that if I had something like you're describing, which to me sounds like a kind of, as you say, a reconciliation and a time to really fully understand the cultural influences that have made me the person that I am. If I'd had some of that going into medical school, I think it would have prepared me for some of the kind of the shocking moments that I had as a student and as a doctor, like interacting with, you know, some of the tutors, the teachers and things like that. There were so many of these uncomfortable situations, and I really didn't have a vocabulary to describe how it made me feel. And so I wasn't really able to deal with it in the moment. And I think just having more of a deeper understanding of myself going into that would have really, really helped. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really, really appreciate you.
Thank you, Rolika. It's been a joy and love the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Brand New Doctor. I hope it inspired you in your personal journey. Check out the notes for a summary of the show with all of the important links. And if you enjoyed this,